With Dr. Ellen Umansky, and it is all privilege. So we're continuing down the theme of women of the Jewish and Christian Bibles, and we continue with Ellen.
Good morning.
Shabbat shalom.
Beautiful morning. This is great.
Well,
I'm happy to be with all of you today and talk about one of the most infamous women of the Hebrew Bible, Jezebel, or in Hebrew, Isabel. And let me just start. I'm going to hand out. We're going to look at it. We also will look at part of the Tanakh itself. Let me just begin by saying, in one sentence, who Jezebel was.
So Jezebel was a Phoenician princess. She was the daughter of the king of Phoenicia. Phoenicia was an area in what is today Syria, Lebanon, and northern Israel. So she was princess of an area that wasn't far north of where the northern kingdom of Israel was. She lived in the 9th century before the Common Era, and stories about her can be found in Kings 1 and 2, which apparently originally was simply one book. So by the time the Bible was canonized, 1 and 2 Kings become two separate books, but actually they were written at the same time. In thinking about Jezebel this week, I thought that it's ironic, I don't know what other word I can use, that although last week we talked about Sarah, who of course was the wife of Abraham, and the individual with whom God makes his promise to continue the covenant, down through the child and then the grandchildren, Abraham and Sarah. There are more detailed stories and lengthier stories about the villainous Jezebel than there are about Sarah. And so whereas last week I think I was fairly successful in including and excerpting all of the stories about Sarah and Hagar about whom we know very little from the Bible itself, as we'll see this morning, there are several stories about Jezebel. And again, they really try to portray her in a certain way. Right? In other words, one of the things about Jezebel is that all the villainesses of the Hebrew Bible, the editors or the writers of 1st and 2nd Kings, never had anything good to say about Jezebel. And so one of the things I want us to look at this morning is that in the biblical text itself? Is it how later interpreters have viewed it? You know, how bad was Jezebel? Did she really deserve to be, I can never say this word out loud, eponymous, right? With the word, the word Jezebel has entered into the English language, and someone can be a Jezebel. So if someone says, you know, you're a Jezebel, I don't know if people use that anymore, but you may remember the Betty Davis movie from the 30s.
Temptress.
So Jezebel is a temptress. What else? As it's used in the English language, what does it mean to be a Jezebel? Clearly a woman, obviously, a temptress.
Seductress.
Right, seductress, right? So her sexuality is really an important part of who she is.
I thought it was also that she was inconstant.
Not dependable.
Okay.
So
yeah.
She would seduce and then dump.
And then dump, right. So she's strong, right? She's a very strong figure, makes it clear what she wants. I would say she is devious. It's not a nice word to be called, to say that someone is a Jezebel. But,
a harlot.
Yeah. According to one biblical author that we'll not be looking at this morning, so I thought I'd bring her in, Josie Bridges Snyder, in an essay called Jezebel and Her Interpreters, Snyder says that Jezebel is one of the few biblical characters treated almost uniformly negatively, both in the biblical text and in the subsequent interpretive tradition. And she means by that both the rabbinic tradition and the early Christian tradition. As Snyder points out, the story of Jezebel is told within an androcentric text. In other words, we have these stories about Jezebel, but they're all told in texts that really try to focus on either her husband Ahab, or the prophet Elijah, or the prophet Elisha. So she does appear several times, but again, there were stories of Jezebel, but you have to recognize that they are within other stories in which the biblical authors, at least, are focusing on the male figures. That is, she's never the center of the story, and yet she appears numerous times in 1st and 2nd Kings. I thought that before we started the handout, this is the Women's Bible Commentary, edited by biblical scholars Carol Newsom, Sharon Ringey, and Jacqueline Lapsey. And on page 80 in this book, Snyder just gives us a list of all the things bad that Jezebel does. She says, while never the center of the story, Jezebel appears numerous times in the narrative of 1 and 2 Kings. She kills the prophets of Yahweh, the Hebrew God. She provides sustenance to the prophets of the Canaanite and Phoenician gods and goddesses, Baal and Asherah. She threatens revenge against Elijah after the episode at Mount Carmel, which we'll look at this morning. She orchestrates the murder of Naboth in order to obtain his field or his vineyard for her husband, and boldly meets her death with painted face and freshly done hair. From the viewpoint of the author, and here she identifies the author as the Deuteronomist, that is the man or men who wrote the book of Deuteronomy, everything Jezebel does is sinful, and she fully deserves the gruesome death predicted by Elijah and Elisha. Moreover, while we have no indication in the text that Jezebel's misdeeds include sexual exploits, Yehu, God's chosen usurper, accuses Jezebel, as we'll see, of, quote, whoredoms, you know, acting like a whore, and sorceries. Whether Yehu intends to insinuate sexual looseness or, more likely, religious infidelity, that is, the worship of multiple deities, is not clear. After her death, Jezebel is neither mourned nor buried, and the text never speaks of her again. And yet her character is not silenced. Her influence, perhaps greater than any other woman's in the course of Israelite political history, continues to live on, for better or worse, in the course of interpretive history. Before I pass out the handout, I do want to say one thing about, you know, who is the author of 1 and 2 Kings? According to the Talmud, 1 Kings, when they talk about Kings, the book of Kings was written by the prophet Jeremiah. The prophet Jeremiah lived in the 7th century before the Common Era, and he actually did live around the time that 1st and 2nd Kings was written. But in the 20th century, and certainly by the 1930s, biblical scholars, Jewish and Christian, agree that 1st and 2nd Kings was not written by Jeremiah. It was written by the same author or authors of the book of Deuteronomy. And to figure that out, they do a lot of literary evidence, including phrases that even you and I could easily identify, even looking at the translation. And so I would say today, I think traditionally religious Jews still ascribe Kings to Jeremiah. But again, if you were to take a course on 1 and 2 Kings at a university, or hopefully an adult education class, the author of 1 and 2 Kings is the Deuteronomic author. But again, it's interesting because we are talking about authors that lived at the same time. So there seems to be universal agreement that this is a text dating from the 7th century BCE, talking about figures like Ahab and Jezebel, who lived in the 10th century BCE. All right. So in any case, these stories of 1 and 2 Kings are being written 300 years after the fact. And again, the author kind of makes that clear with things like in those days or back then. Mm-hmm. Right? So the author himself or the authors don't claim that actually they're eyewitnesses to what is happening. And so, you know, when you have that, you have to look at these stories and question whether they historically took place. But from our perspective, or for our purposes, I don't think it really matters. The question is, who is Jezebel in the biblical text? And how has she been seen by the rabbis and by people today? Not just scholars. I mean, I think her, you know, knowledge of Jezebel, she's probably one of the best known characters. Right? Would you agree? In the Hebrew Bible. And maybe even more so for Christians than Jews. Yeah. But I think it is because the word Jezebel has really found its way into the English language. So I have these handouts, which include most of the biblical texts. Where my copy is,
and as these are being passed out, if you see that there aren't quite enough, if you wouldn't mind sharing. And we're also, we have enough Tanakhim. However, I think a bunch of them must have ended up in the main building. Oh. So we'll need also, if you're sitting next to someone who has a Tanakh, if you could share, and we'll spread them out a little bit more too.
We're good so far.
King over Israel in the 38th year of King Asa of Judah. And Ahab son of Omri reigned over Israel and Samaria for 22 years. Ahab son of Omri did what was displeasing to the Lord, more than all who preceded him. Not content to follow the sins of Jeroboam son of Nebat, he took as wife Jezebel, daughter of King Ethbaal of the Phoenicians. And he went and served Baal and worshipped him. He erected an altar to Baal in the temple of Baal, which he built in Samaria. Ahab also made a sacred post. Ahab did more to vex the Lord, the God of Israel, than all the kings of Israel who preceded him.
Right. So who preceded him? I actually wrote it down for myself. I certainly couldn't memorize this. So, you know, you have David, you have Solomon. You have Saul, David, Solomon. You have a united kingdom. Right? Then the kingdom splits after Solomon's death. And you have Solomon's son, Rehoboam, who becomes king of what he thought would become the whole kingdom, but in fact it divides, and Jeroboam becomes king of the north. So you have Jeroboam, you have then Nadav, Baasha, Elah, Zimri, Tibni, Omri, and then Ahab. And then you have, after Ahab, the two sons of Jezebel and Ahab, first Ahaziah, and then Yehoram. All of these kings are terrible. Right? So this is a series of kings who did what was pleasing to the Lord, what was displeasing to the Lord. And, you know, the Hebrew Bible, especially the Book of Kings, Samuel and the Book of Kings, what do kings do that's especially displeasing to the Lord? There are a lot of things you can do, but when you're talking about the north especially, there was a major problem in the northern kingdom after the two kingdoms were divided. And that problem was
idolatry.
Idolatry, right. And we know, I mean, one of the things that I used to love about the Jewish Museum's permanent collection, which has been completely changed, so you can't see this anymore. But it used to be when you went into the first room of the permanent collection and you looked to the right, you would see these god and goddess figurines, especially goddess figurines, Asherah figurines, little fertility goddesses with large breasts and big hips, that were excavated in the northern part of Israel. And in fact, there was one one figurine that was excavated in the same place in Tekoa where Amos, the prophet Amos, was said to have lived at the exact same time that Amos is saying, God hates your Asherah, these goddess fertility figurines. So idolatry was a big problem in the north, more so in the south. And why would that be? Why was idolatry such a big problem in northern Israel? What?
Anybody know?
She said proximity.
Proximity to?
To what?
Right, to Jerusalem. Okay, so when the kingdom was divided, Jerusalem is in the south. So the southern kingdom had Solomon's temple. And so people could go and bring sacrifices, that is, the first of their flock or the first of their fruits or grains, to the priests at the temple in Jerusalem. And that's what the Israelites who lived in the north were also supposed to do. But it was a schlep to go from the north down to Jerusalem. And so many of the kings, and doubtless some individuals, but we don't know of them in the Bible, created their own altars. And in fact, this also was at the Jewish Museum. They're somewhere in storage. But you could see actual altars that were made, that were excavated in northern Israel. And supposedly what was supposed to happen at those shrines was, again, offering sacrifices, although without a Levite, without a priest, to actually offer a sacrifice to God. And it was in the north that idolatry primarily became a problem. And it was a problem because many of the kings married foreign wives. And according to the biblical authors, these women who were not Israelites, brought the worship of their own gods and goddesses with them. And according to, again, 1 Kings, Jezebel would be one of the most guilty because she continued to worship Baal and Asherah, and her husband began to worship them as well. So what it says here in what Ellen read, okay, first I want to go, not content to follow the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat. So what exactly was the sin of Jeroboam? I'm just going back and looking at this. Right, because the author doesn't tell us here what the sin of the first king of the northern kingdom, Jeroboam, what his sin was. He basically created two golden calves, and he set them up in different parts of the northern kingdom. And he encouraged northern Israelites to basically worship at the foot of the golden calf. He committed idolatry. But according to the author of 1 Kings, what Ahab did was even worse than what Jeroboam did. And so he took his wife Jezebel. I mean, that's not what he's being, that's not the condemnation. The condemnation was that after Ahab married Jezebel, he went and served Baal and worshipped him. Now, according to this text, did Jezebel introduce the worship of Baal to Ahab, her husband?
No.
I mean, he marries this woman who's worshiping other gods and goddesses, and he decides to follow suit, and he serves Baal. Who was Baal? Baal in Canaan and in Phoenicia was the son of El. El is a generic term in the ancient Near East for God. So the ancient Israelites would refer to their god as Elohim, right? And the Canaanites and Phoenicians called their god El. The Hebrew god, of course, then gets a proper name, right? Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh becomes his personal name. So he is that El, he is a generic God, but he also, by the time of Moses, reveals himself to be this deity whose name is Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, the unpronounceable Yehiyeh, or Yahweh. So Baal was a god worshipped in the ancient Near East. He was seen as the son of El, but more powerful than El. He was the god of nature, and he was seen as someone, as a god, a deity who was quite powerful. So we read here that Ahab went and served Baal and worshipped him. He actually went as far as erecting an altar to Baal. An altar is a thing that you sacrifice animals or first fruits from, in a temple of Baal, which he built in Samaria. So not only did he build this tiny little altar, he actually built a temple. A sanctuary. A special holy place to this deity Baal. And then Ahab made a sacred post. Now, I don't know what, do you have a JPS translation? Because that's what I have. If you have that, it should say a sacred post. But that isn't what the Hebrew says. The Hebrew says, Ahab made an Asherah. An Asherah.
It says sacred post.
But in the Hebrew, it says Asherah. And I think it says Asherah. I don't know why it doesn't translate it as Asherah, but I can tell you that when I think of little goddess figurines, and especially household gods that Israelites would have, it seems that that developed a few hundred years after the early 9th century. Here, Asherah does refer to poles or posts, or some kind of decorated trees that were put by King Solomon in the temple in Jerusalem, and then later by such kings as Ahab. And so, if you know in English, you really don't get what is sacred about a post or a pole. It's that it was a pole or a post which symbolized Asherah. In other words, you're not making a graven image. You're not actually carving out a figurine. But you are putting something in your place of worship or in your place of sacrifice that will be dedicated to the gods. So it turns out that he not only is worshiping Baal, but he's worshiping Asherah as well. And so therefore, Ahab did more to vex the Lord, the God of Israel, than all of the kings of Israel who came before him. Yeah.
Name is Frank. So I'm intrigued by the sacred post because there's general prohibition that's mentioned elsewhere in the Bible or in the Tanakh, wherever it is, about sacred posts. And I never understood that versus Isaac, who, I believe it was Isaac, when he slept, it must have been Jacob, he built a monument of stones, mm-hmm. and that was okay,
right.
But later on it becomes, you won't make sacred posts. So my question is, in all these later, is the Jacob sacred post, is the Hebrew Asherah,
right.
And is the later ones all Asherah?
Right, no, yeah. So I would say that Jacob builds, the Hebrew was in my head and now I just lost it. What he builds is something out of stone.
Right.
It's not an altar.
Mantiva, yeah.
It's in my head. Right, so he doesn't build an altar to another deity. Asherah becomes the most popular among the Israelites of all the foreign goddesses, but there are others. There's the goddess Anat. She's also a goddess, but Asherah seems to be the most popular and will become more popular than Baal. Because Baal is male, the Israelites already have a male god, the god that they will call the unpronounceable Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. But the worship of Asherah does go on in ancient Israel for quite a long time. And, the whole idea of becoming a monotheistic religion, that doesn't happen until the time of Isaiah. I mean, when Isaiah says, he, meaning God, he is our God, there is none else, That's monotheism. When God says to Moses at Mount Sinai in Exodus 20, you shall have no other gods other than me. I learned that in religious school in the statement of monotheism, but when you think about it, that isn't a statement of monotheism. It's saying there are other gods, and the Hebrew could have said Elohim, which is a false god, but it says Elohim. You shall have no other Elohim other than me, or literally besides me. So the idea of taking a people to monotheism is something that will take longer than the days of Ahab and Jezebel.
I know there are hands up, but we're not going to take them. We're going to keep going and see what kind of time we have at the end. And a reference just to the Baal, to the golden calves that Jeroboam builds, two of them, marking the boundaries of the northern kingdom. And he says to them, Ela Elohecha Yisrael, these are your gods, O Israel. So in the story of the golden calf in Exodus, when Aaron facilitates the golden calf, he too says, in the plural, Ela Elohecha Yisrael, these are your gods of Israel. Some historians of the Bible tell us another story is being implanted into the Exodus story for a reason. And these stories are connected. So the complexity of Israelite, the unfolding of Israelite religion embedded already in early Torah stories. So that's just for us a reminder. And why is it, and just on the visual side, why would a pole be a reminder of the fertility goddess? So just in terms of imagery,
there's more we can say, but I agree with you. We should go on. We go on to, now to 1 Kings 18:1 through chapter 19, verse 3. And here we'll look again at the handout, because this is a long story. I excerpted it, and I think I excerpted it faithfully to the text, and you still get the general gist of what happened. You're going to read it again?
So much later, in the third year of the drought, the word of the Lord came to Elijah, Go appear before Ahab, then I will send rain upon the earth. Thereupon, Elijah set out to appear before Ahab. The famine was severe in Samaria. Ahab had summoned Obadiah, the steward of the...
Oh, should be the...
What? The steward?
The
steward of the palace. Obadiah revered the Lord greatly. When Jezebel was killing off the prophets of the Lord, Obadiah had taken 100 prophets and hidden them 50 to a cave and provided them with food and drink. Obadiah came upon Elijah, who told him to tell Ahab that Elijah was here, but Obadiah was afraid that if he did so, Ahab would kill him. My lord, Ahab, had surely been told what I did when Jezebel was killing the prophets of the Lord, how I hid 100 of the prophets of the Lord. And now you say, go tell your lord, Elijah is here. Why? He will kill me. Nonetheless, Obadiah went to find Ahab, and Ahab went to meet Elijah, who told him that he had brought trouble on Israel by forsaking the commandments of the Lord and going after Balaam. Now summon all Israel to join me at Mount Carmel, he said, together with the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah, who eat at Jezebel's table. Jezebel's table. When Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done and how he had put all of the prophets of Baal and Asherah to the sword, Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, Thus and more may the gods do, if by this time tomorrow I have not made you like one of them.
Meaning what? What does she say? Well, my children.
She's going to
kill him. Right, she's going to kill you. Right? Tomorrow. Yeah.
Frightened, he fled at once for his life.
Okay. Elijah eventually comes back. But the story is that there's actually a story being referenced here, and then there's the actual story. So Obadiah is telling us that Jezebel already killed the prophets of the Lord. Right, that's in the past. My Lord Ahab has surely been told what I did, Obadiah, when Jezebel was killing the prophets of the Lord, how I hid 100 of the prophets of the Lord. So that's something that took place in the past. Obadiah knows that Jezebel thinks nothing about murdering prophets, those who speak on behalf of the Lord, you know, the God of Israel. And now we have another situation where Jezebel and Elijah are really facing off because there are 950 prophets of Baal and Asherah, and then there's Elijah and his prophets of the Lord. And Elijah, what does Elijah do?
Kills all of those prophets.
He kills them, right? He kills 950, from his perspective, false prophets. Right? They're prophets of deities who are not, you know, deities, and what they are saying, therefore, is not the word of God. And what's Jezebel's role? What is Jezebel here? This is what I meant by, you have to find her stories are told within an androcentric text. We know that in the past she killed off prophets of the Lord.
Here she.
Yeah.
But here she warns Elijah and gives him time to escape.
Right. Yeah, she does. Right. So she doesn't come after him. Right. She could have come after him.
Right. She didn't kill him.
She didn't kill him. Right. That's exactly the reality. Right. When Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done and how he had put all of the prophets of Baal and Asherah to the sword, Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah. So she is giving him a warning. She's giving him the opportunity to flee. And he's genuinely afraid of Jezebel because he seems to know that she will, in fact, kill him if he doesn't get out of there. Mm-hmm. And so he flees. So she comes across in this story as, I think, somebody who's strong, violent, right? I mean, I don't think she personally killed 950 prophets, but she must have, you know, a great deal of support. And then she has these prophets of Baal and Asherah dining at her table. Again, literally, I don't think she had a table big enough, had 950 people there, but it means that she socialized with them, right? That she socialized with them, they became, I'm going to say, use contemporary analogies, you know, they became her friends. She's a foreigner in a foreign land, right? And you don't really read that much about her relationship with Ahab. In fact, there's really nothing about the relationship with Ahab. She's loyal to Ahab, as we'll see in the next text. But in terms of the relationship that they have with one another, you know, it's not there. Leading modern biblical scholars, that is 20th century biblical scholars, to surmise that maybe this was an arranged marriage. And that, you know, yeah, and that she might have been younger. You know, it wasn't really something she wanted, but at least one of the things she did when she got to northern Israel was she at least continued to worship her gods and goddesses. We now have the longest story about Jezebel. And this story is so long that I wrote here, read 1 Kings 21. Because that would have taken 2 pages just to type this out. So if you have it or not.
Cheryl, the microphone.
A really quick question about the reference to Jezebel having, you know, the prophets of the Lord being hidden away and Obadiah hiding them away. Is that actually actual story in Kings as well? Or is it just
a
reference?
Right, it's just a reference to a story that we don't have to read by themselves. Yes. Which is fascinating. Yeah.
was there such a story? Could it have been put in? I mean, this is an edited text. While it wasn't put in, maybe the story, it's only from hearsay in later generations. We don't know. Okay, let's read 1 Kings 21. Oh, I didn't see the mic. Okay, Cheryl.
The following events occurred sometime afterward. Naboth, the Jezreelite, owned a vineyard in Jezreel, adjoining the palace of King Ahab of Samaria. Ahab said to Naboth, "Give me your vineyard so that I may have it as a vegetable garden, since it is right next to my palace. I will give you a better vineyard in exchange, or if you prefer, I will pay you the price in money." But Naboth replied, "The Lord forbid that I should give to you what I have inherited from my fathers." Ahab went home dispirited and sullen because of the answer that Naboth the Jezreelite had given him. "I will not give up to you what I have inherited from my fathers." He lay down on his bed and turned away his face, and he would not eat. His wife Jezebel came to him and asked him, "Why are you so dispirited that you won't eat?" So he told her, "I spoke to Naboth the Jezreelite and proposed to him, 'Sell me your vineyard for money, or if you prefer, I'll give you another vineyard in exchange.' But he answered, 'I will not give my vineyard to you.' His wife Jezebel said to him, 'Now is the time to show yourself king over Israel. Rise and eat something and be cheerful. I will get the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite for you.'" So she wrote letters in Ahab's name and sealed them with his seal and sent the letters to the elders and the nobles who lived in the same town with Naboth. In the letters she wrote as follows: "Proclaim a fast and seat Naboth at the front of the assembly, and seat two scoundrels opposite him, and let them testify against him, 'You have reviled God and king.' Then take him out and stone him to death."
Nice letter.
His townsmen, the elders and nobles who lived in his town, did as Jezebel had instructed them, just as was written in the letter she had sent them. They proclaimed a fast and seated Naboth at the front of the assembly. Then the two scoundrels came and sat down opposite him, and the scoundrels testified against Naboth publicly as follows: "Naboth has reviled God and king." Then they sent him outside the town and stoned him to death. Word was sent to Jezebel, "Naboth has been stoned to death." As soon as Jezebel heard that Naboth had been stoned to death, she said to Ahab, "Go and take possession of the vineyard which Naboth the Jezreelite refused to sell you for money, for Naboth is no longer alive, he is dead." When Ahab heard that Naboth was dead, Ahab set out for the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite to take possession of it. Then the word of the Lord came to Elijah the Tishbite, "Go down and confront King Ahab of Israel, who resides in Samaria. He is now in Naboth's vineyard. He has gone down there to take possession of it. Say to him, 'Thus said the Lord, would you murder and take possession? Thus said the Lord, in the very place where the dogs lapped up Naboth's blood, the dogs will lap up your blood too.'" Ahab said to Elijah, "So you have found me, my enemy?" "Yes, I have found you," he replied. "Because you have committed yourself to doing what is evil in the sight of the Lord, I will bring disaster upon you. I will make a clean sweep of you. I will cut off from Israel every male belonging to Ahab, bond and free. And I will make your house like the house of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, and like the house of Baasha, son of Ahishah, because of the provocation you have caused by leading Israel to sin. And the Lord has also spoken concerning Jezebel. The dog shall devour Jezebel in the field of Jezreel. All of Ahab's line who die in the town shall be devoured by dogs, and all who die in the open country shall be devoured by the birds of the sky." Indeed, there was never anyone like Ahab, who committed himself to doing what was displeasing to the Lord at the instigation of his wife Jezebel. He acted most abominably, straying after the fetishes just like the Amorites, whom the Lord had dispossessed before the Israelites. When Ahab heard these words, he rent his clothes and put sackcloth on his body. He fasted and delayed in sackcloth and walked about subdued. Then the word of the Lord came to Elijah the Tishbite. Have you seen how Ahab has humbled himself before me? Because he has humbled himself before me, I will not bring the disaster of his lifetime. I will bring the disaster upon his house in his son's time.
And it actually does happen. When his dad is all right, so here we see a fuller portrait of Jezebel. It's not very pleasant.
The more the stories I read, the more I'm thinking, no, she's a strong woman. And once again, they are blaming the woman for the man's actions. So you know, he's such a wimp. You know, he can't act as a king. You know, whether or not she's killing, the king's always killing people and taking stuff. I mean, what did David do? You know, I mean, he sent out what's her name's husband and to make sure he gets killed. Nobody says that was a bad thing to do. He's a king. You know, he does this. I mean, they do in the end. But you're saying. Right, but still, you know, so she gives him what he wants. I mean, admittedly, she does it a little badly, but you know, she figured it out. Nothing any other king would not have done. And because they don't say Ahab could have done something differently or said to his wife, no, that's not a nice thing to do. I mean, no, he goes, whatever.
He doesn't stand up to her, right? She's stronger than he is. She writes the letters.
Right. His name.
Right.
And then afterwards he goes, oh dear, I'm sorry. And God says, oh, you're a man, you're okay, that's fine. You say you're sorry? I mean,
really?
Or do we say he's sorry to spirit so much?
But that's all.
Amy, I agree with you, Maggie, but I think she's like Lady Macbeth. The two of them are this evil power couple, and they work hand in hand, and you can't separate, and you can't make this a feminist story, because I think the two of them are guilty, but she's more, even more guilty.
Like
she's
Andy the power of the brain.
She's the brains behind the action.
I'm going to cry.
Yes, but they don't blame Clyde, they blame Bonnie.
So I think that Jim, Shabbat Shalom, I think there's a really interesting omission. So, Naboth says that he will not give up the vineyard, the door of the door. And Ahab leaves out a critical piece of information in talking to Jezebel. He leaves out an essential piece, and then further along, the Lord is, Ahab speaks to Elijah, and because you have committed yourself to doing what is evil in the sight of the Lord, and it reminds me of the whole ethics of sort of malicious rumor, although it's, here's the trace. The trace is the omission of the connection to Lador Vador. Jezebel may not have changed her path, but she's clearly not given essential information to the transaction. It is just left out. It's just simply, he won't sell it to me.
Right.
Not the reason for why he won't sell.
Right.
Had nothing to do with money, had to do with ancestry, had to do with history. And so I'm not forgiving the ultimate ass, but I just think it speaks very clearly to the ethics of how powerful omission in our conversations with one another can be, and the erroneous conclusions we may come about.
Right. In other words, maybe, I don't know if you agree with this, because Ahab only tells Jezebel part of the story, he doesn't say that Naboth doesn't want to sell because this is his ancestral home and his family has lived there for generations. And the question is, if Ahab had told Jezebel that, Might she have reacted differently? All she knows is here's this stubborn guy who owns a piece of property right next to where the king lives, and you know, the king in her mind has a right to take it. Right? So would she be looked at, you know, is she looked at differently if she didn't ask? Huh?
She didn't ask.
Yeah.
I was thinking, as we read in the beginning, about Catherine the Great, who in an arranged marriage probably was not a Russian. She came from, I forgot exactly where, but she came and she went a step further because she eventually killed her husband and became queen and ruler. But, I don't know much more, but she got the power and she used it.
I mean, do you think that Jezebel really is seeking political power? Is that what this is about? She's talking about seizing the vineyard. Does that make a difference? I mean, if she wanted to seize something, you could see something more valuable than the vineyard that's next door to your house.
Judy, it seemed to me that he was depressed. He was in bed, weeping the day away. And she did what she could to get him up. Cheer him up.
Well, one of the other readings on the hand actually. Yeah, let's go down. Before we look at the last reading about Jezebel and 2 Kings, let's look on the second page of the handout. It was shipped for Fryman Kensky, who's a biblical scholar. We looked at the spoken reading of the Bible last week as well. Tipper does mention this story, and I think her take on it. Tipper Fryman Kensky is a 20th century, she died early in the 21st century. She's one of several contemporary biblical scholars who have tried to rehabilitate Jezebel. So we're not talking about feminists trying to rehabilitate Jezebel, although some of these scholars may well be feminists, but it's really as biblical scholars doing a careful reading of the biblical text. And here, Farmer Kensky writes about what she thinks about the appearance of Jezebel in this story of Naboth and his vineyard. So, you see this on the second page of the Wealth and Power.
Wealth and power magnify the effects of the quintessential foreign wife. Jezebel, daughter of the king of Sidon, the northernmost of the Phoenician cities included as Canaan in Genesis 10 and Judges 3. As the wife of King Ahab of northern Israel, she brought her foreign gods and ideas into the heart of Israel. Her piety was a prime danger, for it magnified the intrusion of a foreign cult into Israel. The next appearance of Jezebel is in the story of Naboth's vineyards. Here, too, she appears as a well-meaning woman who does everything wrong, this time by trampling on Israelite law. Ahab has no tradition of eminent domain that allows a government to take any land it wants, but Jezebel sees that a subject stands in the way of the king's desires, and she will perform kingship acting as she believes kings should act. Ahab's predicament, which Jezebel has made her own, is like David's when he was faced with an inconvenient Uriah. Like David, she will not simply kill a subject without a cover story. Foreign wives bring their own ideas about social institutions, and Jezebel has run roughshod over Israel's cherished traditions. The story of her death reveals a woman of courage. Facing the murderer of her husband's family, the queen makes herself up to look her best and calls Jehu a murderer, comparing him to a long-ago royal assassin who ruled only a week before being assassinated himself. She speaks with dignity, defiance, and grace. Nevertheless, we readers almost cheer when her servants throw her out of the window to be eaten by dogs. Jezebel, operating on a national scale with her royal power, did precisely what Deuteronomy feared. She imported her foreign customs into Israel.
Okay, so we will look at 2 Kings that talks about her death.
and her encounter with Yehu, the king, who becomes king of Israel after her sons are kings of Israel. But before that, what Tipifar McKenzie is saying is that, you know, she's trying to look at this story within the context of Jezebel being a farm wife who doesn't understand why her husband doesn't have the right of eminent domain to the vineyard that is next door to where they live. And she's basing her actions on her own assumptions about royal power.
Cultural differences.
Right, that there are cultural differences.
Lawrence, so I'm speaking quickly to clarify some earlier words here. From all appearances, this will come before me, is that there's a power struggle between Hashem Elohim and all the other Canaanite deities. Not foreign, very much part of just what is it, now that this point of story's point, why this one is different, more eminent, and more powerful, more real than all the others of other Canaanite deities. For instance, Asherah, depicted as a tree with breasts often, the mother of Ashtar, of, you know, the mother of human fertility. This name Jezebel, that's just anglicized from Isabel, means where is Baal? She is a consort of Baal by her name. She is devoted to her deity. There's no question about that. And that first other deity, for instance, that where the conflict is between Hashem Elohim and them too. These are all Canaanite deities. The Phoenicians were basically northern. They didn't call themselves that. The Greeks called themselves that. People of Sidon and Tyre basically were northern Canaanites. They spoke a language, the closest sister language to Hebrew possible. They shared a lot of them. They just happened to have a slight different set of deities. And the Moabites, Edomites, also speakers of Hebrew, linguistically at least.
Right.
But they were all Canaanite deities. The power struggle seemed to be here between Hashem Elohim and the other Canaanite deities. So close. So many of them are actually sharing attributes. Their worship is sharing attributes. And that's why they're such a threat, because they're so confusing to people. They're so closely related. Sometimes it's a sect that seems so close together in some ways. That had a great connection, for instance, in the Perushim and the early 400s we've seen. Perushim and the early 400s were Christians. So close together, and yet with a huge amount of friction then because of the problem of confusion.
Yeah, all I would say, and it is true that etymologically, I mean, her name does reference the fact that she is, there's a relationship of her name linguistically to Baal. But I guess I would ask, why is it in the biblical text, when these kings marry foreign wives, that they can't get the foreign wives to worship their god, but instead these men begin to worship the foreign gods? You know, and I mean, in other words, Jezebel, was there a marriage contract that said that she would get to worship her own gods and goddesses? And I'm sure there wasn't anything, if there was some kind of document written up that said that Ahab would have to worship Baal and Asherah in order to marry Jezebel. It just doesn't make any sense. But it does seem that there was something attractive, especially in northern Israel, about worshiping other gods and goddesses, and it would take a long time to stamp this foreign worship out. So let's look at the last story about Jezebel. This is in 2 Kings, and the fact that it came up. This is chapter 9, verses 7 through 37. So we're back to the first page. And now we have a story of Jezebel and the prophet Elisha.
Good morning, Cheryl. I just want to go back to, so Tikva's sort of read on this and putting it in a more societal kind of context. I mean, if Jezebel was really dignified and stately, I mean, she could have suggested, for example, to Ahab that he institute eminent domain, right? I mean, she didn't have to have the cover story. It's very interesting that she had to engage in this intrigue. If eminent domain, for example, was a tradition in her homeland, I mean, it just seems like she is into the whole devious
intrigue, you know, and not really standing up for what maybe she believes in.
Right. I mean, there's no doubt that the text vilifies her. You know, whether or not there ever was a Jezebel, and if so, whether or not she actually acted the way she's depicted, we have no idea. I mean, that's part of the frustration reading this story. You know, can we totally rehabilitate her, as Tipton Connor McKenzie tries to do? Probably not. I mean, I don't know if I think she's as bad as Lady Macbeth, but she is worse. I mean, there's no doubt about that.
I think it just casts such a bad light on her that it's a warning to the Israelite men, do not marry, obviously. And this is a bad thing for you to do.
David Shabbat Shalom. What you were saying before about you know, the marriage contract or whatever, what was the practice of the regular people in Samaria in those days? Were they idolatrous like early on the Israelites were? I mean, did they have, you know, the farmers, the peasants, the hunters, whatever, did they have these Asherot and all that in the, that they were worshipping besides Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, or what was the story?
I don't know. I mean, see, you know, we just have archaeological evidence. We don't have historical texts that tell us what the Israelites were doing. But, you know, there have been these Asherot, certainly, that have been dug up and dated back to, you know, the period after or during when Ahab and Jezebel were said to have lived.
Ellen?
Yep.
There's every reason to believe that this was the practice of the common person. The archaeological evidence is from not just palaces, but common dwellings that these Asherot were found. The prophets are railing not only against the priests and the nobles, but they rail against the common person. And Jeremiah, and notably, chastises the women, the regular women, for baking pastries to the Queen of Heaven. So this is, it's everywhere.
Yeah, and you know, I have an Asherah figurine that Rabbi Tom was able to purchase for me in a store that he knows of in Jerusalem. We were on a congregational trip. I don't remember what year that was, but it was many years ago. And we had dinner the last night of our trip at a restaurant. And Tom just asked people at the table, if you could own one object or one thing that you don't own, what would it be? Jeff, that was a great conversation starter. I was sitting right across the table from Tom, and I remember saying to him, I would love to have a female goddess figurine. And he said, I know where I can buy you one.
I know a guy.
Has bought and, you know, bought for my children these small oil lamps in Jerusalem that he will often give his bar mitzvahs, soon bat mitzvah gift. And I said to him, well, you know, if you find it, if it's found in one piece, I'm sure it would be thousands and thousands of dollars. But if it's, I think I said I'd pay as much as $300, which is a lot of money for me. But I said, you know, I would love to have one. So he gets back. He stayed in Jerusalem after we left. He comes back. He calls me.
You may remember this, Sharon?
No, because you said to Tom if I was interested, you were interested. But he was very excited because Tom was able to buy this goddess figurine, an Asherah, that was found in hundreds of pieces. And I have it at home. You really can't tell that it was put together. I mean, it's clay. And how do you know that it's an Asherah? Because it's a female figurine, and it's dated. I mean, what he got, you know, it has a date on the year when she was discovered in northern Israel. She has large breasts, she has big hips, and she has no facial features. If she had had facial features, I would have said, well, maybe it's a Canaanite deity, or a deity of some other people. But it does seem that the prohibition against graven images was taken seriously even by those ordinary Israelites who were still worshiping other gods and goddesses.
Interesting.
Yeah. She has what looks almost like a beak or just a kind of a long nose, but it isn't really the shape of a nose exactly. But there you have it. I mean, and for me, it was like really, it still is. It's one of my most prized
possessions. I mean, I haven't.
Bring it next week.
I could bring it next week. Yeah, I could. I have left it in Fairfield a few times. It's so much to, you know, I'm always afraid of dropping it a little bit. But I have to tell you, one of the oil lamps that Tom gave us, I never told him this, but Seth and I were reaching for it at the same time, and it fell on the floor, and it did shatter. And there was a man that my cousin knew of in Eastchester who had this business who put it together, and you cannot tell that this oil lamp is actually in pieces. So I think the same thing with this Asherah figurine that I have.
Are they the same as the Venus de Willendorf from Asia Minor?
Well, you'll tell me when I bring this up. I have no idea.
So if you have class, I think it was.
My name's Ken. I just wanted to suggest that there's probably always been a tendency for men of power to try to preserve their alliance with religious leaders, and that would require, if you're going to kill somebody, that there'd be a cover story. Otherwise, there's going to be, you risk losing some of your support, and you see that today.
I just want to look at the last source on the Second Kings, but I do want to say one thing. There's one thing about this Jezebel Ahab story that makes me question the historicity of it all, which is that if Ahab and Jezebel were so horrible and they worshipped all of these, you know, they worshipped Baal and Asherah, why did their sons, both of whom followed other gods and goddesses and were also not good kings, why did their oldest son become king after Ahab died? And why did the second brother, why did he become king? Well, why didn't the line just go immediately to somebody else? And I don't know the answer to it, but it could suggest that maybe there's something added to this story. I don't know. That maybe Jezebel is made out to be worse than she was. I have no idea. But the truth is her sons, both sons, will become kings of Israel and don't do any better than her husband Ahab did. Well, here's another story of Jezebel. I said there are a lot of stories about Jezebel. This is in 2 Kings. I did the best I could with an excerpt. It's still fairly long, but let's read this one.
Elisha asked one of the disciples to anoint Jehu as king of Israel, which he did. And the disciples said to him, "You shall strike down the house of Ahab, your master. Thus will I avenge on Jezebel the blood of my servants, the prophets, and the blood of the other servants of the Lord. The whole house of Ahab shall perish, and I will throw every male belonging to Ahab, bond and free in Israel. I will make the house of Ahab like the house of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, and like the house of Baasha, son of Ahijah."
Well, let me stop you for 1 minute. So this is the second time that a Jezebel story also mentions Baasha. He was the third king of Israel who murdered the second king. So he also is not seen in a very good light, although I don't know of any stories of him worshiping other gods and goddesses. But he was a military leader, and again, because he was a murderer and murderer of the previous king, which is how he became king, he's not seen as the light. Okay.
"The dog shall devour Jezebel in the field of Jezreel, with none to bury her. King Jeroboam of Israel and King Ahaziah of Judah, Jezebel and Ahab's sons, went out each in own chariot to meet Jehu. They met him at the field of Naboth, the Jezreelite. When Jeroboam saw Jehu, he asked, 'Is all well, Jehu?' But Jehu replied, 'How can all be well as long as your mother Jezebel carries on her countless harlotries and sorceries?'"
Let me stop 1 second. Harlotries and sorceries. In some sources, it's whoredom, you know, whoredom, instead of harlotry. But again, we'll go on and talk about what exactly does this mean. But realize that up until now, I've shared with you all the stories of Jezebel. And one thing we don't learn is that she was sexually unfaithful to her husband. Right? This is a charge leveled against her by Jehu, but you know, he may know something that we don't know. We also don't know from the biblical text that she was a sorceress.
right? We know that she was an idolater. We know she was a murderer. But according to the biblical text, we do not know that she was a harlot or a sorcerer.
Okay. Urim turned and fled, but Yehu shot an arrow through his heart, and he died. Yehu went on to Jezreel. When Jezreel heard of it, she painted her eyes with kohl and dressed her hair. And she looked out the window. As Yehu entered the gate, she called out, "Is all well, Zimri, murderer of your master?" He looked up toward the window and said, "Who is on my side? Who?" And two or three eunuchs leaned out toward him. "Throw her down," he said. They threw her down, and her blood spattered on the wall and on the horses, and they trampled her. Then he went inside and ate and drank. And he said, "Attend to that cursed woman and bury her, for she was a king's daughter." So they went to bury her, but all they found of her were the skull, the feet, and the hands. They came back and reported to him, and he said, "It is just as the Lord spoke through his servant Elijah the Tishbite. The dog shall devour the flesh of Jezreel in the field of Jezreel, and the carcass of Jezebel shall be like dung on the ground in the field of Jezreel, so that none will be able to say, 'This was Jezebel.'"
Maybe the writer is putting a message in her name. Jezebel is dung, fertilizer, and maybe she's revealing his feelings in her name. Dung says it's a Baal, where is the god? But I think this read is better. Jezebel is dung.
She doesn't come to a pretty end, that's for sure. And realize when she says, she calls him Zimri, she says, "Is all well, Zimri?" Okay, so Zimri was another previous king of Israel. What, that Zimri was a previous king of Israel?
The story.
That's a good, how does she know the story? Oral tradition? You know, we don't know. Look. I think Jeremiah, if he was the author of this, would have had more trouble knowing the chronology of the kings than a Deuteronomic author. So that's all I can say. Maggie, we'll go on while we still have time.
Well, so maybe harlotries and sorceries are his cover story. Mm-hmm. He had to have a reason. I mean, he had to state a reason. Otherwise, you know, his murdering is no better than anybody else's murdering. I mean, they're all murdering each other.
I should add that part of this image of a Jezebel, what a Jezebel is, does refer to the part that we just read. When Jezebel hears that Yehu is coming, right, she paints her eyes with kohl. K-O-H-L. She puts makeup on. Right? She puts eye makeup on. And she dresses her hair. So she brushes or combs her hair or does something to make her hair. And hair is, I'm assuming you all know, is that a symbol of temptation, sexual temptation specifically. So here, and also a strength. But in this story, it's part of her using her feminine wiles to help think, you know, to help her have Yehu think that she's not going to cause him any harm, even though he killed at least one of her sons. And of course, that doesn't happen. But this image of a Jezebel is someone who's a sexual temptress, and a lot of it does come from this one part of the story where, you know, she puts on eye makeup and does her hair beautifully. Well, let's look. We hardly have any time left. We're out of time. But let's look at these two other attempts to rehabilitate Jezebel. The first one is on the bottom of page 2. And this is from the Women's Bible Commentary.
Jezebel's very name has become an epithet for women with any number of perceived characteristics, from seductiveness to promiscuity to prosperity to self-assuredness to ruthlessness. Her power, her religious devotion, her ready deployment of violence, the drama and gore of her death, and the attention accorded to her by the narrative all make the story of Jezebel stand out to readers of Kings. Ahab's marriage to Jezebel was surely a political move, creating an alliance with the Sidonians, that is, the Phoenicians. whose kingdom was just north of Israel. In the eyes of the narrator, it is as if Jezebel herself is capable of more harm than Solomon's several hundred foreign wives and 300 concubines put together. From Obadiah's passing reference to Jezebel's slaughter of the Ashwistic prophets, the reader learns that Jezebel is much more than just a bad influence. As the story proceeds, Elijah calls for an assembly with the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table. Again, the reference to Jezebel herself is made in passing, but the implications for her character are profound. Jezebel hosts prophets of Baal and Asherah while actively killing the prophets of Yod-Heh-Vod-Heh. Still, though the narrative does not turn to study Jezebel, watching instead the dramatic showdown between Elijah and the prophets of Baal. By slaughtering the prophets of Baal, and thus answering Jezebel's murders of the prophets of Yod-Heh-Vod-Heh, Elijah shows that his zeal for his God is well matched to Jezebel's own religious fervor. He also knows that she does not make empty threats. Upon hearing of Elijah's deeds, Jezebel vows to kill him within a day, and he must again flee for his life. The replacement of Ahab with Jezebel as Elijah's most terrible enemy looks forward to the story of Naboth's vineyard, when Ahab withdraws from the exploitive privileges of his kingship, and Jezebel takes over in his stead. After Jezebel arranges for Naboth to be stoned to death and instructs Ahab to take over the vineyard, the Deuteronomistic religious polemic gives way to a moral critique. Perhaps Jezebel's foreignness, coupled with the extent of the brutality she has already demonstrated, makes her involvement almost a foregone conclusion. In all of its condemnatory language about Jezebel, the king's narrative never comments on her sexuality. There is no indication that she was ever anything but faithful in her marriage to Ahab, and there is no language in the text that unambiguously points to promiscuity. There is one reference to the many whoredoms and sorceries of your mother Jezebel, but that language reads as a comment on religious practices, either the practice of cultic prostitution that may have accompanied the worship of some deities, or more likely as a metaphor for religious infidelity. That Jezebel has become associated in the popular imagination with harlotry or sexual indulgence is surely a comment on the images of women in the history of biblical interpretation, or on assumptions about female power in our modern culture. The text does not make judgments about Jezebel's sexuality.
And then finally, I want to read from, and I'll read it, from this really fine article, which is a shorter version of a much longer article. This is an article that appeared in Biblical Archaeology, which is a popular archaeological magazine, but yet Jenna Calgames had a much longer version for a more scholarly journal. So this essay, which we put on virtual library. Right? Can you upload it now? Yeah, but you can upload the entire article. Janet Haugaines is a biblical scholar, and here's what she writes. For more than 2,000 years, Jezebel has been saddled with the reputation of the bad girl of the Bible, the wickedest of women. This ancient queen has been denounced as a murderer, prostitute, and enemy of God. And her name has been adopted for lingerie lines and World War II missiles alike. But just how depraved was Jezebel? In recent years, scholars have tried to reclaim the shadowy female figures whose tales are often only partially told in the Bible. Rehabilitating Jezebel's stained reputation is an arduous task, however, for she is a difficult woman to like. To attain a more positive assessment of Jezebel's troubled reign and a deeper understanding of her role, we must evaluate the motives of the biblical authors who condemn the queen. Furthermore, we must reread the narrative from the queen's vantage point. As we piece together the world in which Jezebel lived, a fuller picture of this fascinating woman begins to emerge. The story is not a pretty one, and some, perhaps most readers, will remain disturbed by Jezebel's actions. But her character might not be as dark as we are accustomed to thinking. Her evilness is not always as obvious, undisputed, and unrivaled. as the biblical writer wants it to appear. When Jezebel comes to Israel, she brings her foreign gods and goddesses, especially Baal and the consort Asherah. This seems to have an immediate effect on her new husband, for just as soon as the queen is introduced, we are told that Ahab builds a sanctuary for Baal in the very heart of Israel, within his capital city of Samaria. Jezebel does not accept Ahab's God, Yahweh. Rather, she leads Ahab to tolerate Baal. This is why she is vilified by the Deuteronomist, whose goal is to stamp out polytheism. She represents a view of womanhood that is the opposite of the one extolled in characters such as Ruth the Moabite, who is also a foreigner. Ruth surrenders her identity and submerges herself in Israelite ways. Jezebel steadfastly remains true to her own beliefs. What spurs Jezebel to action is unknown and unknowable, but the motives of the Deuteronomist come through plainly in the text. Jezebel is a bold and impious interloper who has to be stopped. From her own point of view, however, she is no apostate. She remains loyal to her religious upbringing and is determined to maintain her cultural identity. Though they will never meet in person, Elijah and Jezebel are engaged in a hard-fought struggle for religious supremacy. Here Elijah reveals that he and Jezebel possess a similar religious fervor, though their loyalties differ greatly. They are also equally determined to eliminate one another's followers, even if it means murdering them. The difference is that the Deuteronomist decries Jezebel's killing of God's servants, but now sanctions Elijah's decision to massacre hundreds of Jezebel's prophets. Indeed, once Elijah kills Jezebel's prophets, God rewards him by sending much-needed rain, ending the 3-year drought in Israel. There is a definite double standard here. Murder seems to be accepted, even venerated, as long as it is done in the name of the right deity. When Jezebel applies eye makeup before she sees Yehu, whom she knows is on his way to kill her, Jezebel is donning the female version of armor as she prepares to do battle. She is a woman warrior, waging war in the only way a woman can. Whatever fear she may have of Yehu is camouflaged by her war paint. Her grooming continues as she dresses her hair, symbol of woman's seductive power. When she dies, she wants to look her queenly best. She is in control here, choosing the manner in which her attacker will last see and remember her. Positioned at the balcony window, the queen does not remain silent as the usurper Yehu arrives into town. She taunts him by calling him Zimri, the name of the unscrupulous predecessor of Omri, Jezebel's father-in-law. Zimri ruled Israel for only 7 days after murdering the king and usurping the throne. It's all well, Zimri, murderer of your master, Jezebel asks Yehu. Jezebel knows that all is not well, and her sarcastic, sharp-tongued insult of Yehu disproves any interpretation that she is dressed in her finest to seduce him. She has contempt for Yehu. Unlike many biblical wives who remain silent, Jezebel has a distinct voice, and she is unafraid to articulate her view of Yehu as a renegade and a regicide. Well, thank you all today. I'm sorry about